I think the through line of the program today is market forces. And not even stocks either. Let's talk oil and consumer and labor market forces, shall we? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday today, the 4th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I'm going to give you a number here at the top of the program that will maybe help contextualize the seriousness of our situation as if it needed it in week 8 or so of this lockdown. The Treasury Department announced this afternoon that in the April through June quarter, that is to say the second quarter of this year, the one we're in right now, it's going to have to borrow $3 trillion. Dollars to handle coronavirus expenses. I mean, technically, it's $2.99 trillion, but what's $10 billion between friends, right? Told you that so I could tell you this. We've gotten an update from the Small Business Administration about the second round of that Paycheck Protection Program. $175 billion in loans have been approved as of Friday. That means there is still a bunch of money left to lend. And for the banks that are processing those loans, that is good to know. Marketplace's Justin Ho gets us going.
Going into this past weekend, the Bank of Southern California was eager to hear from the SBA on how much loan money had been approved so far. Nathan Rogge is the bank's CEO.
It helps a lot to know how much money is still available. You know, what resources do I need to work through the weekend?
Now that the SBA says PPP funding is still available, Rogge says the bank is going to start reaching out to customers and letting them know they can still take advantage of the program.
I think a lot of people's perception was, oh, it's a complete mess. I missed the boat.
Bay State Savings Bank in Western Massachusetts is preparing for a surge in new applicants, says Bank President Peter Alden. The bank's employees are working long hours to submit applications during times of the day when there's less competition.
You know, there's been a lot of applications that have been inputted at night and other off hours just to make sure that they get through.
Many new applicants are likely to be really small businesses with one or two employees.
I think what you're seeing now, or at least on our level, what we're seeing is our largest customers have already participated.
That's Chris Duncan, a senior loan officer at LaSalle State Bank in Illinois. Those smaller businesses are likely to take out smaller loans. So Duncan says it'll likely take a week for the remaining $135 billion to dry up. Still, he sees no reason to slack off.
We can't look at that number and sleep on that number because in our mind, at any point in time, that money could disappear.
And even though money is still available, banks should be helping out the customers who have already applied, says Richard Beyer, CEO of the Nebraska Bankers Association.
I think the process now needs to shift going forward to how do we manage loan forgiveness? How do we help make sure that the borrowers are in compliance?
And help customers manage the financial implications of reopening. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
We say not infrequently on this program that the market is going to do what the market is going to do. And it seems the Texas Railroad Commission agrees. The commission was set to vote tomorrow on whether to limit oil production there as a way to stabilize prices, basically what OPEC does. Turns out, though, they punted, theory being it's already too late to regulate and that perhaps the market has already bottomed out. Marketplace's Scott Tong explains what's going on.
This morning, a key member of the Texas Commission that regulates oil, who is in favor of supply cuts, threw in the towel. He said on TV his proposal was dead. Now, most analysts say he didn't have the votes. And to energy economist Mark Finley at Rice University, state regulators didn't have to cut supply. Low prices already did that by forcing money-losing drillers to shut down.
The market's already there, or moving in that direction. The market wasn't waiting for the Railroad Commission to make a decision.
And now he thinks the market is moving on to recovery. Driving and flying are restarting in parts of the world, and oil prices are creeping up.
We may have seen the worst of the demand destruction as the economy begins to get back into motion here in the U.S. and around the world. And as of last Friday, the biggest coordinated production cuts in the history of the world oil market have taken effect.
That is, OPEC and non-OPEC countries are dramatically cutting supply, so the world's massive oversupply may be shrinking. Maybe. Now, the virus could surge in the fall, so the key to oil market researcher Anne Louise Hiddle at Wood Mackenzie is whether the stay-at-home rules stay lifted.
The recovery in demand will be driven by the easing of those containment measures.
The other if is whether the world has a COVID-19 vaccine next year, giving travelers some assurance that it's okay to move about the planet.
Our forecast is based on the assumption that there'll be a vaccine in the market in the second quarter of next year. We just made that assumption. That kind of a recovery won't happen if we don't see a vaccine developed by then.
It is striking hearing energy experts talk about public health uncertainties. But as one analyst put it, the leading economic indicator is the virus. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Traders squeaked out a win today right at the bell. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You know how when you know something's going to be bad, you can kind of get yourself ready for it and maybe make it not be so bad? Yeah, that's not going to work on Friday morning when the April unemployment report lands. We know it's going to be bad and it's going to feel real bad to see the actual unemployment rate in this country jump to 15 or maybe 20%, even though we know it's coming, right? Back before this whole thing started, we introduced you to 10 people we are using to form a sort of representative sample of the American labor force as a whole. It's a series we're calling The United States of Work. Anyway, today, two of those 10 people, that is to say 20%, are unemployed. One of them is Neil Cairns. Until about a month and a half ago, he was a bartender at the Game Night Lounge up in Portland, Oregon. Neil, it's good to talk to you again.
Yes, good to be back.
So the last time we had you on the program was literally the day that the governor of Oregon closed bars and restaurants to customers. What happened to you after that?
So since then, I've obviously been out of work. Just kind of waiting for our bar to open back up, see if we're going to be able to weather that. And in the meantime, I've just been kind of taking care of stuff around the house. Been doing a lot of yard work and trying to get by in the meantime.
Yeah, well, let me ask you about that getting by. Have you gotten your $1,200 relief check from the government yet?
I did. I actually got it pretty quickly. So,
all right, fair enough. Good. Now, things that might not be so painless. Unemployment. I'm going to assume you've applied. How's it going?
I have, yeah. I applied almost right away. And that's been pretty good. Here this last week was the first week I didn't get approved for it. I'm not really sure why that is. I tried to get a hold of them again, but just haven't been able to get through. Yeah, I'm sure they're swamped. So,
yeah. So, did you not get a check this past week?
So, yeah, the last week was the first week I did not get any check. So,
okay. So, how big a hole does that blow in your finances, which I imagine are fragile at best?
They're pretty frayed. It's going okay, actually. We did get the previous checks. We used that $1,200 to kind of bridge the gaps, and of course, we do have several roommates, and several of them are still working. So it's helping. So, a week like this, even 2 weeks, probably not too big of a problem. If it goes beyond that, then we're probably going to start seeing some real issues.
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head what the reopening status is for the state of Oregon, but let's say you don't open for a little while. Are you going to try to get some other kind of job? I mean, you got to make ends meet somehow, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty much going to have to. If there isn't a pretty big change, if something else doesn't come through, then, yeah, I'm going to have to find some job where I'd be considered essential and get back out there and be working again.
Yeah. How are you holding up, by the way? I mean, you're an outgoing guy. You got into bartending, I think you told me the first time we chatted, because you like being out and with people, and that's sort of the exact opposite of what life is like right now. So how you doing?
It's a little rough. I like being around people. I like to be active and working, just outside of a financial side, just the mental and emotional side of just being this isolated for so long is definitely takes a toll.
For sure. All right, so I'm going to try this, and you may actually laugh out loud at me once you hear what the question is, but it was the foundational question of our series that we initially started profiling you in, and the foundational question is, you, meaning all, 10 of you people that we've been talking to, are the people who make this economy work, and is this economy working for you? And so the question is, as bad as it is, with the $1,200 and unemployment and the prospect of having to go out and get an essential worker job, is this economy working for you right now?
I would say not. I would say that for this economy to be working for people like me, that there's going to have to be some reevaluations of how we work the economy. What we have right now is definitely not working for me. If it continues like this, I'm going to have to put myself into a dangerous situation where I'm more likely to become, you know, infected and potentially die. So,
Neil Cairns, used to be a bartender at a board game lounge, actually, called Game Night Lounge up in Portland, Oregon. Neil, thanks a lot. Best of luck, and we'll talk to you soon, okay?
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
What we buy and how we buy it has changed a lot in the past 7 or 8 weeks, right? The need, though, to buy groceries hasn't really changed much at all. So we have checked back in with some of our regular contributors to see what they're seeing in the grocery aisles in this new economic normal.
My name is Kelsey Sproul. I live in Iowa City, Iowa. We, as a family, had planned several trips for April, May, June, and July that are now off the table. I had a couple of work trips, but the ones we were looking forward to were a road trip to Colorado and Utah to see our families, and so that was a bit of a blow. And to add insult to injury, we're getting really cheap gas these days. The grocery chain where I shop offers a discount on gasoline, so after buying all of the groceries to feed the four of us every meal of every day, I accrued a large enough discount to last week fill up my car for 15 cents. We got 16 gallons of gas for 15 cents.
This is Ellen Murphy from Mission Hills, Kansas, and I have not been even looking at prices lately. I put on a mask and gloves, and I run into the grocery store and grab what I need and leave. So I'm not very good on whether prices are going up or not, but I do know that I bought a $16 packet of toilet paper, and it didn't even have a price on it. I didn't know it was that $16 till I got to the checkout.
This is Kelly Koletsky from Columbus, Ohio. The past couple of months have really changed the way I view money. You know, a couple of months ago, I would pitch a penny just to see how far it would go. But I've really transitioned from being cheap to being incredibly grateful. I'm grateful that, you know, things have gotten better at the grocery store. I even saw toilet paper the other day, and even though I didn't need it, it really made me feel good, almost like, in a way, a return to normal. So I am truly grateful that, you know, there are still groceries to be bought, and I am incredibly grateful that there's a means for me to pay for them.
That's Kelsey Sproul in Iowa City, Iowa, Ellen Murphy in Mission Hills, Kansas, Kelly Koletsky in Columbus, Ohio. Coming up,
I'm being an independent adult for the first time ever.
Coming of age in the age of coronavirus, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 26 today. That's a 10th percent, 23,749. Underwater most of the day was that index. The NASDAQ found 105 points in the couch cushions, 1.2%, 8710. The S&P 500 up 12 points, 0.4%, 28.42. Scott Tong was filling us in on domestic energy production. So, energy companies, how about? Chevron guzzled up 2.2% today. Marathon Oil climbs 5.6%. ExxonMobil, 4% to the good. Tyson Food reported second quarter income fell 15% from the previous year because of the virus. Tyson chopped off 7.8%. Hormel Foods sliced down 0.3%. Today, bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury notes landed at 0.62%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Disney reports first quarter profits tomorrow. Suffice it to say that that earnings call is not going to be the happiest place on earth. Theme parks are shut down. Ain't no big time live sports for ESPN to broadcast. No movie production either. And that is going to be the status quo for the near term future, even if some cities and states have started easing up on quarantine. So how might one go about guessing the near term future of corporate America? If one chose to do that. Marketplace Jasmine Gars is on that story.
Ugly. That's a word analyst Tuna Amobi with research firm CFRA uses to describe Disney's upcoming quarterly report. He says right now he's considering which companies can handle pain.
Yeah, the question is how much pain? I mean, I think that, we still have probably another 2 quarters or so of this.
In other words, can companies withstand the reality that COVID-19 may not be going away anytime soon? In fact, some analysts are warning clients about the possibility of a second wave of infection. But Neil Macker at Morningstar says we haven't even gotten past this first wave yet. When forecasting for companies, one has to consider several pressing factors.
Public opinion, the other one is public liability, and the other is, you know, just their general regard for their patrons and wanting to make sure they're safe.
He's predicting theme parks and other businesses that depend on people being able to gather freely won't even consider reopening until September. He says they'll keep taking a hit in 2021. And not just theme parks. Live music analysts say they don't expect to see concerts resuming this year. Tourism analysts aren't optimistic. And Shane McMurray with Wedding Report, a company that collects data on the wedding industry, says the possibility of a second wave of infections is also on consumers' minds.
Most people are postponing. But even then, like with postponements, now people aren't going to travel. People aren't going to gather in large quantities. So you probably see those guest counts come way down.
He expects COVID to impact his industry for years to come. Cities may open up again, but he's not sure that means people's wallets will, at least for some time. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Perhaps, just perhaps, you've picked up on how grim the economic outlook is right now and how widely the pain is being felt. Virtually every industry except maybe medical supplies and cleaner and disinfectant manufacturers has been hit, as has pretty much every part of the labor force to one degree or another. So, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams went to check in on how things are playing out for older workers.
Lynn Lipman is a clinical research specialist in St. Louis, Missouri. Because of the pandemic, the university where she works needs to cut costs. Some people got furloughs. Lipman will have her hours reduced by half.
When they cut the hours, one of the things we discussed was transitioning that over the next few months to retirement.
She's 70 and was already planning to retire later this year, but
it sort of just speeded up the process a little bit.
People 55 or older make up about 1 in 4 workers in the labor force today, and so far, they've experienced fewer job losses compared to their younger counterparts. Richard Johnson runs the program on retirement policy at the Urban Institute.
Historically, older workers have been less likely to lose their jobs than younger workers. Because older workers have more seniority, that does tend to protect them.
That's the good news for older workers.
But when they lose their jobs, their unemployment durations are very long.
Johnson says during the Great Recession, people 62 or older who were laid off were much less likely than younger workers to ever get another job. And that created another trend. Matt Rutledge is a fellow at the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College.
There was a huge spike in 2008 and 2009 in people claiming their Social Security benefits early, right at 62 or just whenever that job happened to disappear.
Meaning people chose to take smaller Social Security checks for the rest of their life rather than face months or years of potentially fruitless job searching. And Rutledge expects another big surge in workers forced into retirement this year. Today, those that still have their jobs can find that even carefully planned retirement strategies may need revising given all the market turmoil. David Ammon is a financial advisor with Edward Jones.
When they see their accounts fall down in value, it's something that they really worry about, whether or not they're going to be able to retire the way they want or whether or not they can stay retired.
So he's checking in and reviewing plans.
Asking them how much longer would we have to work in order to live the retirement we want, or what sacrifices would we have to make to retire now?
Encouraging them to make choices while they still have options. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This month was supposed to be about prom and graduation and senior skip day, and now, of course, it's not. And all those high school seniors, just like the rest of us, are dealing with a boatload of uncertainty and maybe thinking about the economy more than they used to. Anyway, that's the setup for today's installment of our series, My Economy.
I'm Vivian Dragon. I am a senior in Midland, Texas. Midland, Texas is a very oil-based community and economy. Everyone can feel it when the price of oil drops here. There's just sort of a sense of uncertainty and anxiety in the air because in about 2008, 2009, there was an oil bust here, and I was only about 7 years old, but I remember how empty the town was and how there was very little traffic. I think that everyone here remembers the bust, and we're all worried that it's going to happen again. This is one of the biggest years of my life. I'm graduating high school. I'm moving out, and I'm being an independent adult for the first time ever. And I mean, coronavirus is definitely making me unsure if I'm going to get to do any of those things in 2020. Which would be disappointing, but I think it'll be worth it if it's keeping everyone else safe. Next fall, hopefully, I'm heading off to college, and my parents are paying for my tuition, but I'm paying for everything else, so that's clothes and when I go do something fun with my friends. Basically, everything non-essential. This summer was just going to be a good time to make a lot of money and save up. I'm planning on working as a lifeguard at a private pool here in Midland. I've worked there since I was 15 years old, right after my freshman year of high school, but I'm a little unsure if I'm actually going to have it this summer. It would mean I would have to probably either get a job at school or count on working next summer, because this summer is going to be hopefully a big time for me to make a lot of the money I'm going to need in college.
Vivian Dragon in Midland, Texas. Do us a favor, let us know what's going on in your economy, would you? You can do that at marketplace.org. And while you're there, check out a thing Molly Wood and I are doing. 10 minutes every day, our podcast, Make Me Smart, helping make today make sense. It's available wherever fine podcasts are available. This final note on the way out today to be filed under the, gosh, capitalism can be funny sometimes, huh, tab? Hat tip to Josh Barrow at New York Magazine for this one. You heard over the weekend, perhaps, that Warren Buffett has sold all of his airline stock. It is a big deal. Buffett's holding company, Berkshire Hathaway, owned 10% each, give or take, of United, American, Delta, and Southwest. Interestingly enough, though, Buffett hasn't always been a huge fan of commercial aviation. In his 2007 letter to Berkshire shareholders, speaking of airlines and their insatiable demand for capital, Buffett wrote this: "If a farsighted capitalist had been present at Kitty Hawk, he would have done his successors a huge favor by shooting Orville down." I mean, first of all, that's a pretty good line, right? Second of all, history matters, people. Okay, that's it. The Dow up 26 points today, a 10%. The NASDAQ, 105 points to the good, 1.2%. The S&P 500 gained 12. That is 0.4%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer. And I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.